Thelema, Coast to Coast, Show 19, January 22nd, 2006. Thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. I'm John Crow, the host of the show. A lot has been changing with the show since the last podcast about 2 weeks ago, so I have a lot to say, as well as a number of announcements and listener feedback. The first exciting thing is that Thelema Coast to Coast has been picked up for syndication by Circle of Souls Pagan Radio. So I want to welcome all the new Circle of Souls listeners who are hearing the show for the first time. For those who don't know about Circle of Souls Pagan Radio, it is an internet-based streaming radio station that plays gothic, industrial, and electronic music 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Thelema Coast to Coast is going to be broadcast on Circle of Souls on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. If you go to the Circle of Souls website, www.circleofsouls.net, it has the complete listing of when the show can be heard at any particular time in any particular time zone. So I encourage everybody who has not listened to Circle of Souls Pagan Radio to do so. And to those who are hearing the podcast for the first time on Circle of Souls, thanks for listening. Second, this podcast is going to be the first of enhanced podcasts. Today's main subject is a lecture from Richard Kaczynski given at Thelesis Oasis in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania on November 19, 2005. This is the first enhanced podcast that I've ever created, and in it has slides from Richard Kaczynski's presentation. I've done this because when listening to the lecture, one can understand what Richard is saying and get a good idea. However, there are a number of times he discusses a particular list of items or charts, and so if anybody is interested in seeing those charts, I wanted to have a way for them to have the lecture and the information that was visual. This also has a number of slides relating to the material that I'm talking about now, and also the artist at the end of the show. One thing that you all should be aware of is that the enhanced podcast is only available on the Thelema Coast to Coast website, www.thelemacoast2coast.com, and that you have to sign up for the website to download it. The second thing, unfortunately, is that it is in Windows Media Video format, which means it can only be played on a Windows machine. I apologize, I do not have any media production software that allows me to combine the images and the audio to create some kind of MPEG format. All I have is Windows Movie Creator, and that's what I used for this. Hopefully in the future, I'll be able to get some type of authoring environment that will let me produce MPEGs that will be compatible with both PC and Macintosh. However, for now, it is only Windows. The Thelema Coast to Coast website has been updated with a number of postcards, and the last three have been from listeners in other countries other than the United States. I received a very cool postcard from Luiz in Germany. This is a postcard that has Aleister Crowley on a modified cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And it for some reason, every image on there has a resemblance of Crowley. It's very amusing, and I encourage everybody listening to go to the website and check it out. Also, I received some cool original artwork from Mike in Canada, and a very cool postcard from Christian in Norway. So thank you all very much for sending in those postcards. As I said, they're up on the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Now, for sending in the postcards, people get a Thelema Coast to Coast sticker. This is a large white sticker that has the Thelema Coast to Coast logo on it, and it says Occultism Without Apologies and the Thelema Coast to Coast URL. If you'd like to get a sticker, all you have to do is send in a postcard, hopefully a creative postcard, either something that you've created or has a very nice design on the front. Doesn't necessarily have to be Thelemic, although that is preferred. Send that in to the show at Thelema Coast to Coast, care of John Crow, P.O. Box 7045, Marietta, Georgia, Marietta, Georgia, GA. Zip code is 30065, and that's in the United States of America. Regardless if you send a postcard or not, you can always give feedback on the Thelema Coast to Coast website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, or send an email to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com. I really appreciate feedback a lot. It is actually what keeps me going in making the podcast. I also like audio feedback since it's an audio show, and you can do that by calling the Thelema Coast to Coast listener line at 206-20-AGAPE or 206-202-4273. Speaking of feedback, I wanted to read some of the messages that I've received from some listeners. This one's from Julia in Sweden. It's a short and sweet one. It says, "Great show, most relevant even for Wiccans in Sweden. Keep up the excellent work. Blessed be and 93. This is one I meant to read on the last show, however, I was short on time. It's from Gregory, and he writes, "Dear John, first I want to thank you for providing the occult community with such a valuable resource. I found your show just before going on a long road trip to Colorado in November. Driving from Tennessee to Colorado is a long trip, and you kept me company through the whole thing. It helped me get back into the great work at a very trying time in my life. What you're doing is very important to me and others, so I want to give back, even if it's something small. I noticed you were asking for music to play after every show, so I thought I would give you some. While I'm not a member of the OTL, I'm a practicing ritual magician and have been for many years." He gives a bunch of details on his band, which I hope to be playing soon. "Keep up the wonderful work, and I look forward to more informative shows. Gregory." Well, thank you, Gregory. I appreciate you sending in the music. And for those who are not aware, at the end of every show, I play a song from a pagan or occult-related band. Either the song is about occult themes, or the musicians are occultists, and I like to promote their work. I'll be getting more into that in a little bit. Another email from Bob. "Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Hi, and thanks for the car stickers that arrived last week. I've had one on my bumper for a week now, and so far none of the locals have marched on my house bearing burning torches. As I mentioned on my postcard, Freighter Spiritus in London suggested I listen a while back, since I can't get to lodge meetings. I'm glad I did, as I think you're doing a great job with adult content, in the proper sense, even though I keep veering between thinking Keith 418 is spot on or a pain in the arse." "Love is the law, love under will. Bob in Cornwall." Well, thank you very much, Bob. I appreciate the email. And lastly, I have an email from Brad. It says, "Hello, 93. Just wanted to give you some feedback about Thelema Coast to Coast website and the podcast. I recently came across your site and have been a listener and surfer ever since. I wanted to give my thanks and let you know to keep up the good work with the site and particularly the podcasts. I have been interested in Thelema magic and the work of Aleister Crowley for many years, and I have a good amount of material for a beginner, but it was just until not too long ago I became a more serious practitioner in my area, so it is something difficult to get advice and pursue the art of magic. Since finding your website and listening to the podcast, it has been very enlightening and helpful. I appreciate the site and the information I have been able to learn so far. I find it great not only for beginners like myself, but also great for more advanced students. Plus, you discuss other things going on in the Thelemican occult communities. Thanks once again, and keep up the great work. 93, Brad. Well, thank you very much, Brad. I appreciate the emails. I appreciate all the feedback from all the listeners. And again, if you want to send an email, that can be at podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com, or you can go to the website and leave feedback there, or you can call the listener line at 206-202-4273 and leave a message. Now, one of the things that I've been hearing lately is some people concerned that they can't listen to the podcast because they don't have an iPod. This is a big misconception about podcasting. Podcasts usually come out as MP3s, which means they can be listened to on any MP3 device, including an iPod, any portable MP3 player, a PSP. It can be listened to on your computer, a PC or Mac, or anything that can play an MP3. You can even burn CDs and listen to them in your cars. So there's really nothing holding anybody back from listening to a podcast, either Thelema Coast to Coast or any other. So I want to encourage all of these listeners to make sure they let others know that people can download the podcasts and listen to them or stream them right off the internet. If you go to the Thelema Coast to Coast website and click on the link, many browsers, including Internet Explorer and Firefox, will start receiving it and playing it, depending on your settings. So you can listen to it right in your computer. You do not have to have an iPod. As I've mentioned on previous shows, Thelema Coast to Coast is a member of the Proud Pagan Podcasters Network. This is a group of a dozen or so podcasters who've gotten together with their podcasts and share resources, information, and promote each other's shows. I really encourage all my listeners to go to www.paganpodcasting.com and check out the website and listing of the other pagan podcasters. Plus, there's a forum for some discussion and talk about the podcast. I'm sure most of the listeners will find other podcasts that will be of great interest to them, and I highly recommend one called Dio's Shadow. And speaking of Dio's Shadow, on his recent podcast, number 10, he did a very funny satire of Jeopardy called Pagan Jeopardy. And he has a little fun at just about everyone's expense. So I've asked him if I could rebroadcast it, and Dio gave me permission. So here is Pagan Jeopardy.
Welcome back to Pagan Jeopardy. All three contestants have money on the board. Before we continue, let's get to know our contestants. Ceremonialist, how are you?
I am excellent.
So, what do you do?
I am a poet, a painter, a physicist, a computer programmer. I am a botanist, a healer, a musician, and a dungeon master.
No, what do you do for a living?
Oh, I work at the supermarket.
Okay. Eclectic, you say you've been pagan for 150 years, but you don't look a day over 16.
I've been pagan now for 3 past lives, and in my last life, I was Willow from Buffy.
But that show is set in modern times.
Past lives transcend time, Alex.
All right. British traditional witch, can I call you BTW for short?
Of course, my dear.
So when did you move from the British Isles?
Oh, I've never actually been there.
Oh, with your accent, I thought you were from there.
Well, in a very important way, all pagans are from Britain, Alex.
Okay, well, let's start the round. BTW, you have the board.
Can I have Wiccans in prehistory for 500?
Stonehenge, the Venus of Willendorf, and the pyramids were all made by this Wiccan coven. Eclectic.
What are aliens?
No, not aliens. Ceremonial.
Who is not Wiccans?
That's right, not Wiccans. You have the board.
Aleister Crowley books for $100,000.
Audio clue. In Magic, in Theory, and Practice, Aleister Crowley wrote the following in this ritual.
I stole launch the blood, the wafer soaks it up and the high.
BTW.
That's Oathbound.
Oh, I'm sorry. You have to phrase the answer in the form of a question. Eclectic.
What is the mass of the phoenix?
That's right. Choose a category.
Wicca for dummies?
For how many dollars?
All of them?
Choose from the screen, please.
Oh, for 100.
He is the goddess's consort, often depicted with horns on his head. BTW.
That's Oathbound. What is that's Oathbound?
No, I'm sorry. That's not. Ceremonial.
What is Kether?
No, lower. Eclectic.
What is consort?
Was that a real question?
Every question's a real question.
Your questions aren't.
Oh, God.
Who is Yud-Heh Vav-Heh?
That wasn't for points. Okay, look, the round is over. Now it's time for Final Jeopardy. The Final Jeopardy answer. It goes on your altar. It goes on your altar. Okay, the answer was, it goes on your altar. Ceremonial. Let's see what you have. You wrote, what is a perfectly square cloth of natural silk fibers in the shade of 66% charcoal black, measuring 36 inches by 36 inches, with a thickness of 3.36777 millimeters and a thread count of 333, double-stitched along each length at 1/8 inch inset using blind hem and stretch blind hem stitches along the lengths and overlock stitching on the corners with pure black thread crafted on a Tuesday? That's not exactly right. Let's see your wager. You bet 0 = 2? What does that mean?
Well, Aleister Crowley wrote...
Never mind. Eclectic. It goes on your altar. Let's see what you wrote. You wrote, what is everything? I'm sorry. That's slightly too specific. And you wagered all of my crystal collection. You can't wager... Never mind. BTW, it goes on your altar. You wrote, what is the high priestess? Because the high priest goes on top. Although that's right, it's not the answer we were looking for. And your wager? That's Oathbound. Of course it is. Okay, we have no winners today, but tune in next time for Pagan Jeopardy. I'm Alex Trebek. Good night.
I hope everybody enjoyed that. When I first heard it, I could not stop laughing. So that's why I asked to have it on the show. Just a few other things regarding music. In the last podcast, I incorrectly spoke when I called the band Mercury. The band is called About Mercury, and I apologize for that error. So please go to www.aboutmercury.com, and you can listen to Morning Star, the song I played on the last podcast. Also, exciting is the fact that Thelema Coast to Coast now has another sponsor, Latex Records. And actually, over the next 5 or 6 shows, I will be playing a bunch of albums from Latex Records and giving an album away on each show. I will have more information about that after Richard Kaczynski's lecture. So, as I was saying before, this is a lecture presented by Richard Kaczynski at Thelesis Oasis in the Valley of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, as part of a weekend program inaugurating the new Thelesis Temple space. And for those interested in knowing more about that, contact Thelesis Oasis at thelesis.org. Anyway, on to the lecture of Richard Kaczynski called The Evolution of Magical Practice in the Career of Aleister Crowley.
Well, thank you for coming out here tonight, or today. And my talk here today is going to be on the evolution of magical practice in the career of Aleister Crowley. This is a reprise of a lecture that I gave at Noticon in 2003, which is out in Portland. And figuring that not a whole lot of people from the East Coast may have been there, this was a good opportunity to share that talk over on this side of the country. And always been told it's good to start a lecture like this with a joke. So my joke is three magicians walk into a bar. One of them's a Golden Dawn member, one of them is an AA ceremonial magician, and one of them is an OTO member. And they're all comparing notes about their conquests of the night before. And the Golden Dawn initiate says, "Oh yes, last night I made love to my woman three times, and I've recorded it all in a series of sonnets which we published in a limited edition of 100 copies plus two in Japanese vellum. And in the morning she looked at me and said, 'Oh, last night was just pure magic.'" And the AA guy says, "Oh, that's nothing. Last night I made love to my woman, my scarlet woman, five times. And I recorded them in my magical jot diary as Opus 55 through 60, noting the characteristics of the workings. And it should be studied by generations to come." And in the morning, she looked at me and said, "Oh, last night you were like a great wild beast." And then the OTO magician looked up, and the other two looked at him, and he didn't say much. And so they said, "Well, how about you? How many times did you make love to your woman last night?" And he responded, "Once." And the other two laughed and laughed, and finally when the laughter subsided, they looked at him and said, "Oh, yeah, what did she say in the morning?" He responded, "Don't stop." And there's actually a point to that joke, and that is that as Crowley advanced through his career from stirring up in the Golden Dawn, basically seeing that organization fold and then advancing his own studies and practices, starting the AA and developing magical practice that way, and then in terms of him being introduced to the Golden Dawn practice of magic, his own view of performance of ritual and ceremonial magic evolved and changed over his lifetime. And so the point of this talk really is to follow that history of Crowley's practice of magic and show how he, in essence, evolved from being a ceremonial magic magician. And he spent a lot of time doing this. I mean, it's not like he, you know, went through this in a span of months, but he was, you know, a Golden Dawn style magician for close to 10 years. And then he started to see an efficacious way of doing magic that involved more ecstatic style ritual, not so much a structured ritual, but something that involved a more loosely defined approach whose goal was to create a state of spiritual ecstasy or an altered state of consciousness, whereby communication with astral entities, or however you might want to call them, became possible. And ultimately he became exposed to the OTO system of sexual magic, and that ultimately became his modus operandi for the rest of his life. And there's this point where you see the shift happening, and from that point on, I mean, he's not doing big ceremonial magic rituals anymore. He's strictly doing, you know, the sex magic stuff. And, you know, it takes a while. I mean, he's doing the ceremonial stuff for a good, you know, 10, 20 years before that shift happens, but there's this procedure, this process, and we'll go through that. And so this first thing I'd like to talk about is the Golden Dawn Z2 document. And the reason I bring this up is I was having a conversation with someone not too long ago about Crowley's idea of magical formulas. And I think, you know, if you're trying to understand what Crowley says about magical formulas and magic theory and practice, you really need to understand what the Golden Dawn Z2 document was, because this is where Crowley came from. And so when he starts talking about things like, you know, EAO and OM and things like that being magical formulas, and you can use these to design rituals, and he says that every true name of a god is actually the formula for that deity's invocation, it goes back to this Golden Dawn approach. And what the Z2 document basically was is it's looking at the neophyte initiation of the Golden Dawn. That was the first introductory grade of the Golden Dawn, kind of akin to, you know, the Minerva or something. Not that they're exactly the same, but, you know, it's that first step into the order, the 0 = 0 grade. And the Golden Dawn Z2 document had it that you could take this general process of the neophyte initiation and you could tailor that to any other type of magical operation that you want. Because essentially what happens is, you know, the candidate is brought in and is essentially presented to the Hierophant and taken around to the four quarters, and each of the four quarters, you know, they're saying something like, unconsecrated, unpurified, thou canst not pass here. And so they consecrate the candidate each of the four quarters, and finally just re-presented back to the Hierophant, and he's initiated. And that here is you can follow that general formula with the talisman. If you've got a talisman to consecrate, you take the talisman around the four quarters, you know, purify and consecrate the talisman, and basically take that talisman through the same sort of initiation ritual that a neophyte might go through. And the Z2 document basically outlines how you could use this neophyte ritual to do evocation, consecration of talisman, and any of these other things, invisibility, transformation, spiritual development, divination. And when you see Crowley talking about his experiments with invisibility, he's talking about how he was in Mexico and he was able to do this ritual and he walked down the street in his magical robes and no one paid him any mind. He's talking about the invisibility operation of the Golden Dawn V2 document. And I think the important thing about this is the Golden Dawn then basically was created as a very structured outline, saying here's a formula, here's a way you can go through an entire ritual, and then you just kind of plug in the missing pieces and you've got a template, essentially, for doing ceremonial magic. And just to kind of go into a little bit of detail here in this formula, there involves an opening, the candidate is admission, the candidate is conducted around, an oath of obligation is administered, and then, again, the candidate is taken to the north, to the south, and so on. And so there's this procession that goes on, involves, you know, hoodwinking and prayers and invocations and things like that. Ultimately, you know, the oaths are administered, there's a knowledge lecture, an address to the candidates, advice, and then, various officers have speeches, and you close. So by following this formula, we could, again, perform any of these other practices of magic. If we look at the Equinox, Volume 1, Number 3, and this is where Crowley was publishing the Golden Dawn documents. We see that on these instructions that Perdurabo, which is Crowley's magical name, the Golden Dawn, drew up a ritual for the evocation into visible appearance of Typhon Sep, in which, by raising the sigil of Typhon to the grade of 1 equals 10, which would be the Zealotry grade in the Golden Dawn, he bewitched a certain refractory brother of the order, known as Frater DPAL, who at this time was worrying DDCF, who was matters, with legal proceedings. So again, Crowley talks about using this very formula that we're talking about to conduct magic, and Crowley actually offers and reproduces in this issue of Equinox a talisman of fire of Jupiter ritual that he did, using these same ritual structures. So we know that Crowley took this idea and ran with it and applied it. And if you look at Crowley's works for 10 years, from 1898, which is when Crowley became a neophyte in the Golden Dawn, up to about 1908, we see various magical texts that Crowley writes devoted to this approach. Libra Abba, or Book 4, is a prime example of that. Magic Theory and Practice, which is written just a little bit out past this window, again, talks about very structured ceremonial magic practice for the most part. Libra E and Libra O, which gets into banishing rituals and things like that, again, is a very structured sort of document. And in Magic Theory and Practice, there are various other formulas that he talks about in that context, saying that just like with the Golden Dawn Z2 documents, we can look at Iao, Elohim, Om, and other magical words and create rituals structured around these names. In fact, Crowley kind of talks about Iao in very general terms for any magical working. He says, you know, according to the classical Golden Dawn formula, Iao stands for Isis, Apophis, Osiris. And he says that anyone going through a magical ritual, or even in the longer term, going through a great magical retirement, winds up going through this Iao formula. And the way he describes the Iao formula is saying that there's, you know, Isis is the honeymoon phase. You've just gotten started, you're real energetic. You know, and you can really see this if you're doing like a long-term, you know, retirement or, you know, great magical retirement. You're excited, you're really charged up, you're doing the work. And then you kind of get to this point, the apophis stage, where you just hate this. You decide, oh my God, I'm so sick of doing this. I have to get up and do resh one more time. You know, I just want to sleep in for a change. Damn it. And then after you get through that, there's this rebirth, the Osiris phase, where, you know, you find the love of what you're doing again, and you're back into it, and that carries you through the ritual. So this, you know, creation, annihilation, and reconstruction can be the basis not only of a ritual, but certainly you can see this happening, you know, in longer spans of time as well. And just as some examples of Frilly's formal rituals, he worked with the Goetia, we know, from his confessions. He's got all sorts of interesting stories about how, you know, Goetic demons marched around his flat in Chancery Lane. And the Equinox, he publishes a ritual for the evocation and the visible appearance of the great spirit Toth Tartara. And he goes on to Magic Theory and Practice, which he wrote many years later. He says this is a very perfect example of a classical, old-style ritual. So again, at the time he's writing Magic Theory and Practice, you know, his thinking is kind of moving beyond this, but he's still saying this is kind of a classical formula, and it's a great example. And one interesting thing about Toth Tartara is that, again, he structures the ritual to kind of follow the name of that spirit. So there's, you know, a section that corresponds to Tav, a section that corresponds to Pe, and so on. And that what's happening at ritual is consistent with what that letter of the name symbolizes in terms of Kabbalistic correspondences. I mentioned the Talisman of Fire of Jupiter with ritual that was published in the Equinox. He also has rituals of the magical invocation of the higher genius, the operation of invisibility. In the Equinox number 7, where he talks about the festival of the equinox, his equinox ritual, it's, again, a very formal, structured ritual. The invocation of Horus according to the divine vision of W. the Seer, which is based on instructions that Rose gave Crowley in Cairo for receiving the Book of the Law. Liber Pyramidos, which was Crowley's attempt to take the Golden Dawn initiation rituals and boil them down to their essence and kind of get rid of all the extra junk and say this is really what the initiation rituals are all about. And same thing happens to the OTO, because what Crowley did with the OTO initiation rituals is he took the Masonic initiations. You know, he took Yerker's stuff and said, okay, let me kind of throw out all these long, boring speeches, boil it down to what's really the essence of these rituals, and that's the OTO initiation rituals. And finally, we see the Gnostic Mass. And it's around the time that Crowley writes the Gnostic Mass that his interest in doing this kind of structured formal ritual tapers off. So it's interesting that, you know, the OTO and Gnostic Mass rituals are the ones that he writes kind of as he's taken this as far as it can go. And these rituals really are kind of the flower of that approach. And he's really worked it out in his head, and these are just fantastic rituals, as, you know, I think we all would agree. So just to kind of go in, again, a little bit more detail on this ritual for evocation of Toth Tartara. This ritual is actually by Alan Bennett, not Crowley. But Alan Bennett was one of Crowley's teachers in the Golden Dawn before, you know, everything blew up. And this, you know, there's these very formal sections with titles: the opening, the invocation to the higher, the invocation, the potent exorcism, the stronger and more potent exorcism, the conjuration of the intelligence of Tyriel, the prayer unto the great God of heaven, extremely powerful conjuration, and the final admonition. I kind of love that stuff. I mean, it's in a way, it's very Goetic in this sense, because you've got these, you know, conjurations that you use, you know, and first you say, oh, spirit, show up, come on. Hey, spirit, and you get the second more potent conjuration saying, spirit, come on, show up, if you don't show up, I'm going to like start knocking on your neighbor's doors, so you better show up here, or I'm going to be really angry with you. And then the third most potent conjuration is like, okay, listen, I'm going to go over your head and call your boss and complain about you if you don't show up in this triangle right now. And we see the same sort of thing happening here in this ritual. And the potent exorcism, what's being said and the instructions that are given follow the letters of the name Toph Tartaref, which I've got in Hebrew there at the bottom of the screen. And then we get to the invocation of Horus according to the divine vision of W. the Seer. We've got a picture of Rose there on the side, and she's the one that gave Crowley these instructions. And Crowley's first ideas were, okay, here's what we do. Okay, we're going to have like this preliminary stuff, and I'm going to banish, and then I'm going to do the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, and then I'm going to do the lesser banishing ritual of the hexagram, and then the flaming sword, and the abracadabra, I'm going to do it, and then we're going to do invoke, and Rose is like, dude, no. Listen, you know, Horus is talking to me, and this is what he says you need to do. You have this confession, you've got conjuration, it's going to be in four parts, you know, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, and Dalet. And all basically essentially what's happening is the Dalet part is the same as the first part, except rather than you this, you that, you're saying I this, so you're kind of identifying with Horus. I remember it's an impromptu adoration. And then further out, you know, Crowley's saying, oh, come on, can I banish? And Rose is like, no. We're going to try a different formula. So again, you see this idea that Crowley had this structure he wanted to follow, he was very used to. And even at this point, you know, when Rose is channeling the energies of the new eon, that formula, you know, it's being challenged and saying, no, we're going to do things a little bit differently now. In this context, I think it's interesting to say that in the 1940s, Crowley had this correspondence with a wandering bishop by the name of W.B. Crow, who wanted to start doing the Gnostic Mass. And they had a lot of discussion about not only the Mass, but the OTO and its history and the practice of magic. And at one time, Crowley writes to this guy, and he says, you know, for most practical purposes, you know, the formulas of the Aeon of Osiris still work, and basically that's what has to be done for expediency. Crowley's saying, yeah, somebody needs to come around and work out the formulas for a new Aeon. He says, but it's not me. You know, Crowley's basically saying, I was born in the Aeon of Osiris. My brain is stuck there. Someone later needs to figure this stuff out, and I'm not the one. And he says, some of this stuff you see in the appendices to Magic Theory and Practice, you know, stuff like Liber Reguli and some of those other things, and that's kind of pointing the way. But you know, Crowley readily admitted he was, you know, he was a child of an old age, and even though he was a prophet of the new eon, he was still a product of that old age, and a lot of these things need to be worked out. And I think that's kind of the exciting thing for us being where we are as magicians. You know, these things aren't all worked out, and we're still experimenting with these formulas, and time and history and success will be our proof, and so on. And as I mentioned, Liber Pyramidos was Crowley's attempt to distill what was really potent and powerful about the Golden Dawn formulae, throwing away all the blah blah and all the long speeches and all of that, and really getting down to the essence of what that ritual was. And in this case, they focused on the Adeptus Minor ritual, which, of course, in the Golden Dawn system corresponded to the Grade of Tiferet, which is traditionally where the adept, you know, attains knowledge in the conversation with the Holy Guardian Angel. And, you know, in the Golden Dawn ritual, you know, it's again, it's a Rosicrucian type of rite. It's Christian in nature, and there's a part where, you know, the candidate is bound upon the cross of suffering and all of this. And, again, Crowley incorporates part of that into Liber Pyramidos. And if you look at Pyramidos, and you'll see that the cross of suffering is still part of that ritual. But at the same time, it's much more stripped down, it's much more potent than its origin rite is. And essentially, this practice of taking older rituals and kind of pulling out their essence, you know, what really gave them the rituals the juice, and refiguring them, gave Crowley the experience that he needed to, again, revise the Masonic initiations into their modern OTO versions. And evidently, and again, in one of these other letters that Crowley exchanged with W.B. Crowe, he talks about this. And he says that, yeah, Yarker gave him this book of, you know, the 96, you know, the fourth degree through the 96th degree. You know, the idea being that, you know, in standard masonry, the first three degrees are all the same, but then you get these extensions, these other rites, and there's kind of elaboration. So it's the fourth on. That Crowley took from Yarker, and you know, he went out and he revised them, and Crowley says to Crowe that he boiled them down and he kind of showed his notes to Yarker before Yarker died. And Yarker looked at this and said, okay, this is cool. And so Yarker gave him his approval for boiling things down that way. So in that sense, you know, this passing of the baton, you know, at least according to Crowley's account, happened with Yarker's blessing. And then we have the Gnostic Mass. I'm not going to say a whole lot about this because we just spent the morning talking about the Gnostic Mass. But just briefly, Liber 15 was written in Moscow in 1913. And again, this is essentially after 15 years of practicing formal ritual. So Crowley was well acquainted with these structural formulas. And it's just before he began systematically studying the sexual techniques enshrined in the Sovereign Sanctuary of the OTO. He had an inkling of what these were, but he hadn't really sat down and systematically studied those. I mean, that's what you see in the Rex Art Regia diaries, which run from like 1914 to 1920. But again, he kind of had the essence of it there. And so, in this sense, the Gnostic Mass is Crowley's, you know, pinnacle. It represents him putting everything that he knows about dramatic ritual into one rite. And I think it is a very beautiful ritual. Obviously, it's highly structured. It draws a lot from, you know, the Christian Mass, particularly the Roman Catholic Mass. And you see things like there's a creed, there's an invocation of saints, there's blessing of bread and wine, communion, or as we call it, communication, a benediction at the end. I mean, these things are common to both the Roman Catholic Mass and our own, but obviously there's some huge differences. So around 1910, we start to see this shift in Crowley's magical practice from these very structured sorts of rituals to things that are a little bit more free form. And one of these starts with a evening that Crowley started. He kind of did this for fun. He was at the house of a military man, Commander Marston, and they were just kind of playing around. They were, you know, Crowley was reading poetry, and Layla Waddell, she was a concert violinist, so Crowley would read poetry, and she would, like, pick something from her repertoire that was kind of an answer. So he just thought it would be kind of fun to do this dialogue, you know, of poetry and music. And Crowley kind of thought, you know, I think we're onto something here. And so this idea of incorporating poetry and music and dance, which they drafted Victor Neuberg into doing, turned into an evocation of Bartzabel, which they did, again, at Commander Marston's house. And one thing is, and you see here that Crowley's kind of picking and choosing pieces at this point. He's got the Acca Dua chant or song that's used in the Mass, and he's kind of incorporating that into this ritual. And they go through this process of bringing the poetry, playing music. Victor Neuberg does this dance where he's trying to channel Bartzabel, and he falls into this trance at the end of the dance. And they are able, therefore, to interrogate Bartzabel, and, you know, this foretells World War II happening and things like that. And after this ritual took place, that was the inspiration for Crowley to go on and do the rites of Eleusis. We also see energized enthusiasm described in the equinox, again, as kind of this ritual that's semi-structured, but also has a lot of room for freedom or flexibility in it. And again, the rites of Eleusis, it continues to be a very popular series of rituals a lot of OTO bodies like to put on. And they're neat because it does have all these elements. And if you've got people in the Oasis who have, or the Lodge or what have you, that have musical abilities, and you know, there's lots of musicians in the OTO. It's an opportunity for them to come out and play music and give a real personal sort of stamp on these rituals. And this improvisatory freeform ritual eventually leads to what Crowley began to call workings. And the workings started with traditional rituals, an example being the vision and the voice. Rico was doing these Enochian calls or keys. And then eventually he starts to think, okay, let's take this sort of structured approach, and then we can kind of mix in ritual with sex. And that's what you start seeing in the Paris workings, where there's, you know, Crowley's kind of doing, you know, an invocation of either Hermes or of Jupiter, and then there's some sex that happens, and then they start to record, you know, their conversations with the channeled spirits of Hermes or Jupiter. And what happens is that ultimately these workings start to shift away from the structured ritual and more toward this idea of intoxication, whether it be alcoholic intoxication, sexual, intoxication and whatnot. And there are six major workings that we see in Crowley's body of work. It starts with the vision and the voice, which he did in Algiers in 1909 with Victor Neuberg. And again, and it's it follows a very traditional ritual formula where there's these calls that they did in a very strict sort of way. There's one point, I believe it's the 14th ether, where Crowley kind of like, you know, gets to this point and he's like got this block and can't get any further. And his response to this is to, you know, build a temple and have sex with Victor Neuberg. And once that happens, you know, his, you know, Victorian sexual ideas have all been destroyed and evaporated and overturned, and the way is open for the remaining visions to be beheld. And when that happens, Crowley's kind of like, okay, something's working here with this idea of ritual and the sex and the Victorian deprogramming and but he hasn't quite put it all together yet. Then you get the Rites of Eleusis. Abeldees is the working that led to the writing of the book of, book four. And it's one of those things where, you know, Crowley was off in St. Moritz with his Scarlet Woman of the moment, and at this point that was Mary Desty. And again, they had been partying and doing all the fun stuff that crazy ceremonial magicians in St. Moritz do. And much like Rose back in 1904 did, Mary Desty starts talking about, oh, God, I got this vision, and I got, you know, and I see this and that, and Crowley's like, yeah. And he's kind of ignoring it, just like he did with Rose. And then finally, she says something that catches his attention, and Crowley realizes that, oh, okay, she's channeling something here. And he gets these instructions to say, there's a book. You know, it's a book in four parts. You are supposed to write it. And they go on this, you know, magical retirement and start writing book four. The Paris workings were done in 1914. Kind of following a similar sort of ecstatic ritual sort of formula. I mean, yeah, I kind of said a little bit about it, but it was Crowley and Neuberg's workings. The Amalantra workings followed in 1918, where Crowley had these protracted series of conversations with the wizard Amalantra, who was, again, an astral entity that they contacted and interrogated through this trance state that's induced through, you know, the spiritual ecstasy of the working. And then finally, there is the attempted but not terribly successful Cephalidium working at Cephalu. A lot of these things you'd find if you look in the Vision of the Voice of commentary and other papers. It has the Vision of the Voice. I believe it has the Abeldees Paris workings and the Amalantra workings all in that volume. So in one book, you've actually got, you know, the textbook of this sort of approach that Crowley worked with. One thing that's kind of interesting is that the time scale of these workings gets protracted. So traditionally, where a ritual might be, you know, assigned to a particular date, you know, the classical formula has, okay, you pick the day, you know, I mean, so if you're going to do something to do with money, well, then it's going to be with Jupiter, it's going to do that on a Thursday. If it has to do with learning or magic, well, that's Mercury, so you're going to want that to be on a Wednesday, and then once you got the day picked out, you look at the planetary hours, and you pick the planetary hour, and then you have this, you know, ritual, that, you know, this retirement that leads up to, that very strategically chosen moment to do the ritual. Well, if they're working, these are more protracted and drawn out types of experiments that seem to be more driven by opportunity than by the magical hour in the classical sense. Crowley's diary, John St. John, actually is an example of how one could do a great magical retirement in theory, but not have to like quit your day job and go take a house out in the country and cut yourself off from all your family and friends while you're doing it. And just to give you kind of an example of how the time scale of his workings kind of gets longer and longer as Crowley progresses, I've kind of taken these workings, I put them on some calendars so you can kind of visually see what's happening. No, the vision of the voice consisted of 28 workings. I mean, there's 30 ethers in the Enochian system, but the first two Crowley had done in Mexico back in 1900, and then then he kind of went through these in reverse order. He started with the 30th ether, went to the 29th, and after that, kind of got, no, you're not advanced enough. We really can't do this right now. So he put it away, and then came back to it, and finished the last 28 in 1909. So that's why it was only 28 rather than 30 that I'm talking about in this presentation. But essentially what happens is these happen pretty closely together. You know, Crowley and Neuberg went out to the desert, and tried to get this done in short order. So it was more of a classical great magical retirement in this case. The dates that are in lavender there are dates that where working happened, and the dates that are in the darker color, maroon, are dates where actually did two workings in one day. So you see that all 28 days of this ritual, this extended working, essentially get done in about a month's time. So that's November and December of 1909 that happens. You get to the Rites of Lucius. You know, this is driven a little bit by practicality, because Crowley had rented Caxton Hall and was putting on these plays, and people aren't going to show up for plays 7 days in a row. So what he winds up doing is scheduling them to run on successive Wednesdays. So he does one ritual a week. So it takes a month and a half to get through the series of seven rituals in the Rites of Lucius in October of 1910 and November of 1910. When we get to the Abel Dees working, this is the one with Mary Destey that leads to the writing of Liber Abba. We find they're spread out a little bit more, November 1911, December 1911. And essentially the one you see on the 28th is the one that kind of leads them off onto this retirement, and then they relocate to where the working happens, and they have this concentrated period of time and effort where they're interviewing and interrogating the Wizard Abel Dees. At this point, I think it'd be good to pause and say a couple words about these, how to talk to people on the astral planes, you know. And so I've had people who are like doing workings, and I was like, well, okay, you know, I saw this happen at a ritual recently that was. It was in a Wiccan tradition where they were doing this underworld journey, and you know, priestesses were kind of going to these trance states, and they were calling up various goddesses, and the goddesses would answer questions. And it kind of struck me how different that approach was from a ceremonial approach, because what Crowley would do routinely was whenever he contacted something on the astral plane, he didn't believe the entity was telling the story, telling the truth when asked, "Who are you?" And essentially in this Wiccan ritual, it's like, "Who are you?" "Oh, you know, I am Circe." "Okay, I believe you." And then they kind of go off and start asking her all sorts of questions and stuff. Crowley would kind of go, "Abel Dees, well, who the hell are you? You know, who's your patron deity? How do you spell your name? What's your magical number? Blah 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 blah. Give me some proofs, you know, that you know, you are who you say you are." He'd ask these questions, and he'd expect to be convinced that this entity was not, you know, some trickster who was trying to lead him down the garden path, but really was who the entity claimed to be, and he wanted proofs that this person had some authority to be speaking to him. And likewise, Crowley would give his authorities, you know, back to him, because, of course, Crowley was, you know, the great magician, part of Rabo, and the prophet of the Aeon, and blah, 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 so... Of course, he was worth talking to, so... Paris working, 24 workings, a little bit more spread out. December of 1913, January of 1914, February of 1914. What's that?
Took weekends off, yes.
And then we see the exact opposite pattern happen later on. So yeah, this is like Crowley's 9-to-5 gig. He was doing Paris working during the weeks and taking the weekends off to enjoy the Paris nightlife, no doubt. Amalantra, 41 workings. This is when he's in America and he's hooked up with Roddy Miner, who had a day job. So, you know, they did lots of their workings on the weekend when she wasn't working and they could, you know, screw and drink and all this and not have to worry about showing up at work the next day. So, as you see with the Amalantra workings, they tend to fall on the weekends. Again, so the practicalities of having to hold on a day job, structured nature of this working. But still, I mean, it's another thing about this is that, you know, this kind of becomes your life for, you know, 6 months, as these workings work out to be, from, you know, January through June, every weekend just about, you know, is wrapped up in doing these workings. And you know, make no mistake, I mean, I might joke about, you know, the sex and the drugs and all that, but again, Crowley took all this stuff with utmost seriousness. I mean, he took notes. He kept records of all of this stuff. I mean, this isn't just an excuse for partying. This was deadly serious stuff to him. You know, and that's why I still have the transcripts of these things extant. So just to kind of compare, Vision of the Voice, 28 workings, 1 month. Amalantra, 41 workings, 6 months. So these things kind of become more protracted and drawn out. They become more of a lifestyle. You know, they kind of take over your existence for a long period of time. Well, in the midst of this, something kind of interesting happens. And that something interesting is Crowley finds out about the OTO and its central secret. And I don't mean to shock you, but, you know, the OTO has some stuff that has to do with sex. And Crowley basically concluded that Theodore Royce, even though he was the head of this organization, really didn't have any practical experience with the central secret. So Crowley decides, of course, that he would become an expert in this and become very knowledgeable in this technique. So he starts a diary called Rex de Art Regia. And again, if you look through these things, I mean, he becomes very, very detailed. Again, sex is not just, it's not just sex. It's a sacrament. It is a ritual. It's a holy, sacred experience. And he records, you know, every time he has sex, it has an opus number. He records who the partner is. He talks about what, you know, method he used. He has all sorts of abbreviations. And he talks about the results, you know, both of the sex act, but also he talks about, he follows it up and says, well, okay, this operation was for money. Did I get money? You know, he's very methodically trying to track what he does and what kind of results he obtains. And
Richard, could you discuss a couple of the abbreviations?
Elixir rubius, okay. Which means the red elixir, so which is only available certain days of the month. PVN was per vas nefande, per the unspeakable vessel. and in mano domini, IMD, was in the hand of the master. So.
So were those personal workings or partner workings, the ones that are IMD?
It could be either one, actually. Okay. Well, some of my favorites, though, as you read through these, is that he'll say things like, purpose of the ritual, forgotten, or glory to Nui. Yeah, that's it. And some of these just kind of sound like after the fact. It's, oh, God, I don't know. but for the most part, he records these all as, again, sacred, sacramental events in his life. And this is something we report in his diaries till the day he's not able to do it anymore. So again, it's not only a shift in practice, but it's a shift in mindset. Because, you know, I mean, Freud obviously had plenty of sex in his lifetime, but it's at this point where his attitude towards it shifts. It's not recreation, it's sacred. And so I've got the bar charts to show the transition. There's nothing you can't make more interesting with bar charts. So I've kind of plotted, you know, the various workings of cruelty, the number of workings involved in them. So, you know, vision, the voice, you know, consisted of 28 different visions. Rites of Eleusis was 7 rituals. Abeldes was 6 workings. Paris working was about 14, I think. Actually, it's been more than that. It's over more than 20. And Amelandra was 41 workings. And you see, these are kind of episodic. You know, you don't do a working like this every day. I mean, they're big investments, you know, in time and effort. So they're going to be spread out. I think more interesting is, again, right in 1914 is when Crowley starts to do a very systematic study of sex magic, and you're seeing those green bars get bigger and bigger as the years go on. At the time I put this together, I didn't have access for some reason to Crowley's 1919 diary. I mean, it's not that he didn't do anything in 1919, but I didn't have that one to fill in the blank. But you see, this just becomes, you know, a much more prevalent form. It's, you know, essentially a, you know, by 1920, he's got over 100 different operations he's done that year. So it's, you know, not exactly a daily thing, but it's every few days he's working this, trying to solve the mysteries. And my point here in this slide is to kind of show what happens is that Crowley, you know, this isn't something that tapered off. This is something that, unlike, you know, these other practices, continues throughout most of his lifespan. Crowley lived to 1947, but in those last 2 years, his diaries get very sparse. His health is very bad at that point. He doesn't really, you know, make any recordings of operations. You know, there's, you know, when we talk to Pat McAlpine, who bore Crowley's son in 1936, she even talked about Crowley at that time, because he was getting up there in years, you know, having difficulty, you know, maintaining an erection and all of this stuff. So, you know, age caught up with him. But, you know, again, you're seeing it pretty much throughout his lifespan. He was maintaining the regular regimen of magical working. And you see various spikes in this chart, and those spikes essentially correspond to different Scarlet Women showing up in his life. So, yeah, there's quite a number of them that year. Yeah. So it's kind of funny because in his diary, he's kind of looking back and I'm like, no, wait, can I remember the names of everybody? No, I can't, But I think it's that point where he decides that he will tip his hat to every young couple that he sees because it's special. So I think a really good illustration of how Crowley's approach to ritual magic changed is really outlined in this excerpt from Gerald York's diary from 1928. This is right after Crowley met Gerald York. Israel Regardi had just become Crowley's secretary. He had pretty much just met Marie de Miramar. He wound up actually, you know, having to marry her to get her into England because she wasn't a citizen. And so this group of people have basically all came together for, you know, relatively recently, and he thought it'd be kind of fun to demonstrate a ritual for them. And this, in my mind, just stands out in really sharp contrast to the Z2 document, where Crowley's kind of saying, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I'm going to do that, and Rose is going, no, that's not how you invoke Chorus, throw all that stuff out. And this ritual is much more free-form. And, you know, again, I'll just take a moment and read this to you, even though you probably all read it by now, as I was talking. Because, as York says in his diary, the beast began with the banishing ritual of the pentagram and the bornless one invocation. I tried to follow in the astral. That is to say, I concentrated on the words and actions and tried to visualize the gods and forces as he invoked or commanded them. The Scarlet Woman was asked to do a vision during the Mournless One. She saw a lion with small wings and a girl's face pacing sand with pyramids in the distance. The lion ordered her to sleep, and she did so. I certainly noticed at the time that her breathing had become heavy. At the conclusion of the Mournless ritual, or Mournless One, we asked her if she would dance. She had told us earlier in the evening that she had evoked what she called the devil 4 times in her life, once alone, 3 times in company, dancing around bonfires in Nicaragua. She consented. So we put logs on the fire till they blazed, turned out the light. It was a small oval room so that the fire lit it well. We burned a lot of abramelin incense. Marie was wearing a scarlet Arab garment, an abai, fastened at the shoulder with a Masonic jewel. It covered her from collarbone to ankle. Of course, nothing beneath. The beast in a similar cloak, only white and gold, myself in black and gold robe of a probationer, and the serpent, Israel Regardi, in a lounge suit and spectacles. We chanted the Akka Dua mantra, which soon took control, rising and falling spontaneously with the dance, and bringing us all rhythmically together. Marie danced, invoking some fire spirit, at times crooning over the fire, holding her hands, moving her feet in the flames. I had not my stopwatch by me, so she could not check whether she kept them in the flames an abnormally long time. It seemed so to me. The dancing was very effective. She was evoking her devil the whole time. She ended stretched on the floor, willing a sign. At that moment, AC clapped his hands to close the performance. She was very impressed, regarding it as a sign for which she had asked. No real evidence. A far cry from the very structure to the ritual. It's like, okay, we're going to banish, we're going to do the Mournless One, we're going to sit around and talk, well, what should we do next? Okay, let's put a fire on, okay, and let's dance and, like, chant a little bit and see what happens. You know, not that it's a bad ritual, and, again, many people do a ritual this way, but you kind of see how things change Chloe's approach from that very structured approach to this. And this is really one of the few examples of Chloe doing a ritual. You know, after about 1920, you know, and that's, you know, with that sense, Crowley's performance of structured ritual pretty much stopped, except for demonstrations like this. By the same token, you know, by 1920, Crowley had been doing ceremonial magic for 22 years. So it's not, again, he'd been at it for a long time. And this slide I'm kind of showing is that, you know, Crowley's change in his approach to rituals also kind of followed some of his initiatic work. So at the point where he is dealing with formal ritual, this classical approach, is where he's kind of going through the traditional Golden Dawn and Rosicrucian grades of the Golden Dawn. And when he takes on the working, this more unstructured approach is when he's dealing with things like the Abyss experience, becoming a Magister Templi, you know, taking, you know, becoming the leader of his own school of thought, essentially, and as a Magus, formulating the word of the new eon. So I think it's kind of significant that you're seeing this break from the classic, what Crowley called the classical approach, to, you know, kind of a more, you know, modern way of working, I suppose, or a new eon way of working, because that's where Crowley is nipping around the edges of the new eon in his own magical growth. So, kind of revisiting this, just to kind of sum up. So we're seeing the switch from the working to the sexual magic stuff. And again, I think the point I'm trying to make here is that I don't want to downplay the fact that Crowley was very experienced in all of these approaches by the time he moved on to something else. It's not like he kind of whimsically ran through this. At the time he did The Vision and the Voice, 1909, he was 34 years of age. Again, to put perspective on this, he had joined the Golden Dawn in 1898. So he'd been doing ceremonial magic for 11 years by the time he started doing The Vision and the Voice. By the time he goes to the Paris workings, 1914, and when he first begins the systematic study of the OTO sex magical techniques, he's 39 years old at that point. I'm Elantra working, 42. And likewise, you know, this chart of his later years, and it's 29 to 1945, you know, the big peak there with Billy Bush coming into his life in 1931. He's 56 years old there, you know. Then the year he has the more partners than he can name, 63. So, you know, we should all be so lucky. So, in conclusion, if we look at the timeline of all these events, we see that Crowley didn't really flip between these ideas. He really pursued them and he followed them to their conclusion. And he certainly didn't shirk studying these things in their completeness. But he, you know, he did his homework and he transitioned gradually from one approach, whether it be formal ritual, to this, you know, improvisatory form, to these extended workings, into pretty much predominantly sex magic workings. And so we can talk about how these things evolve from this really structured approach that allowed a lot of spontaneity in terms of music, poetry, and dance. He introduced the use of intoxicating components. He talked, you know, in the Confessions, he talks about how he introduced Anhelonia Mellini, peyote, essentially, to Europe. That's his claim. I mean, it's been kind of hard to prove, but Crowley was certainly one of the earliest users of Anhelonia Mellini in alcohol and sex. And eventually, you know, this involves the shoeing, you know, a lot of paraphernalia, you know, and that ritual with York. You know, they talk about putting together an altar, you know, talk about having a pentacle and a cup and all this stuff. I mean, it's a very different sort of approach to idea of magic and how you outfit your temple. One thing I kind of find that I kind of interject into this discussion myself and in my own personal experience is there are cliches out there, and cliches and stereotypes have their basis in reality. And when you talk to, you know, Wiccans about ceremonial magic, they kind of say, oh my god, that stuff is all so boring and dry, it's so structured and blah blah blah. And you talk to the ceremonial magicians about the Wiccans and go, oh my god, they're just like going out there and making it up as they go along, and they have no idea what the hell they're doing. And I think that either one of those is fair, but at the same time, I could say that I've been in ceremonial rituals that have been so structured that it just squeezed the life out of everything, you know. And I've also been at, you know, pagan type rituals that were just so free form. There was like nothing going on at all, and if you wanted to try and reproduce it, because it's, you know, it's just a method of science, there's no way you're going to reproduce it. There's just no one knows what they're doing, you know. They're facing east and calling on the watery west, you know. It's just a mess. But I think there's a middle ground, you know. I mean, structure is important, but at the same time, there needs to be some room there. There needs to be breathing room. There needs to be room for joy. There needs to be room for, you know, we're told, you know, what rituals you rightly perform with joy and beauty, you know, and there needs to be that room for joy and beauty to happen, and it can't happen in too structured a setting. I kind of think about this as like, almost like, you know, like music, you know. You can have, you know, band will perform, will have, you know, verse, chorus, solo, do whatever you want, okay, then you have verse, chorus, end, you know, and I find that to be a nice way to work, because you've got kind of built into your ritual, the room for something unexpected to happen, you know. And that unexpected can even happen, like, you know, someone gets the giggles, you know. So what if you get the giggles during a ritual, you know, just laugh it out of your system and you move on. You forget a line, so what, you know. I remember one time being in this ritual, someone forgot their line. It's like, no, you can't talk in circle, you can only say what's in the script. So someone forgets their line and you're standing around waiting and waiting and waiting, and so it's like, oh, wait a minute, and after like 5 minutes, like, oh, I've got it, you know. Which is a more disruptive thing? For someone to kind of come in and say, hey, this is your line, and move on, or to have this ridiculous rule that that kind of puts a wrench into everything. So you need to have that balance, that kind of tension where you've got structure but not too much, in my opinion. So that is the end of my talk on Crowley's evolution of magical practice.
I hope everybody enjoyed the talk from Dr. Richard Kaczynski. I found it very informative. I'd like to thank Brother Howard and Brother Eric and Sister Judy for their arrangements and the recording of the lecture. I could not have done it without you, so thank you very much. As I said earlier, we have a new sponsor on the podcast, Latex Records, and they can be reached at www.latexrecords.com. I'm going to be playing a number of bands that are distributed by Latex Records over the next 5 or 6 podcasts. The first one I'm going to showcase is The Evolutionaries. The song I'm going to play is called The World Is Ending, and it is from the EP Exoskeleton. The Evolutionaries have been heavily influenced by Nine Inch Nails, Marilyn Manson, Tool, and other bands like that, and I've really been enjoying the music. Also, one lucky listener will get to enjoy the same CD, because I'm going to be giving it away. All you have to do is send an email to podcast@thelemacoasttocoast.com with CD giveaway in the subject, and inside the email include your full civil name and your mailing address. This is open to all listeners, regardless of your country. By sending an email and entering, you agree that I can use your first name and or city and country when I announce the winner on the next podcast. The deadline for entry is February 3rd, 2006. Again, all you have to do is send an email. Do not send any postage, any money, or anything. This is a free giveaway just for Thelema Coast to Coast listeners, but you do have to send your entry by February 3rd. And the winner will be randomly chosen, announced on the next podcast, and I'll mail out the CD to them via regular post. So that about does it for today's show. I know it went a little long, so thanks for listening. Thanks again to Dio for the Pagan Jeopardy, Richard Kaczynski for the use of the lecture and the slides, and to Thelesis Oasis for recording the lecture. And lastly, I'd like to thank you for both listening and for your feedback. Please keep it coming. I really appreciate it. Until the next podcast, love is the law, love under will.